Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I go through the current edition of my Sunday sermon. Ever since COVID started, we've had, like many churches, an interesting response in terms of Zoom small groups. Coffee Break has gone over to Zoom for their small group meetings, and we started a men's group. I always had difficulty getting a men's group going. Men are often getting home from work late, and then to come down to church for another meeting here is difficult. So Reggie really helped us get going with a Zoom men's group. And this week, my friend from Australia, who had brought me out there for that conference last March, Warren Mills, joined our men's group. And one of the things that he did was talk a little bit about the book that he wrote. This was actually his second book. Warren and the men's group shared a little bit of his story and talked about the fact that he grew up in a Christian home, in a Brethren home, which was dispensational. And over his life, he's been in a variety of churches. He's been in Baptist churches. He's been in Pentecostal churches. The church he goes to right now is highly liturgical Anglican church. And he's worked on his Christian faith his whole life, sometimes had doubts and struggles, other ups and downs. Well, after retirement, he decided he wanted to write some books, and this was the second book that he wrote, and the first book that he got published. And basically, the book says Christian life is in many ways more simple than we suppose. Now, for someone like me, who likes to read lots of books and get into philosophy and those ideas, sometimes I am guilty of making things too complicated. And what Warren asserts in his book, How Good is the Golden Rule? Now, in all fairness, it's looking for the copy of it that I have here. In all fairness, it's not a short book, but he says basically practicing the golden rule is the way to learn the Christian life. Do you want to learn to be a Christian? Start by practicing the golden rule. And it's a really very practical and helpful insight, because right there we begin to realize, well, what does it mean to be a Christian? Practicing the golden rule puts you on a particular path. Now, the golden rule is in fact found in the Sermon on the Mount, and it's found in the text that we're looking at this week. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be open to you. For everyone who asks receives, the one who seeks finds, and the one who knocks, the door will be open. Which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you, then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven have good gifts to give to those who ask him? So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. Now, we've been going through the Sermon on the Mount, and I've posted this diagram a number of times, noting how, in some ways, you can see the sermon sort of go in a circle. It's got a chiastic structure, if you're familiar with some of these ideas. But basically, certain passages are parallel to other passages, and there's a key inclusion here. Matthew 5, 17 to 20 says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." And here we have this other phrase that tips us to know that this is a structural segment of the sermon, and basically we're going through the structure here. For this sums up the law and the prophets. So earlier in the sermon, Jesus says, I'm not abolishing them, I'm fulfilling them. And here in this command, this do to others, the golden rule, what you would have them do to you, this sums up the law and the prophets. This is it. Now, what does he mean by the law and the prophets? The law and the prophets was a way in Jesus' time of signaling what we often call the Old Testament, the law, the first five books of Moses, and the prophets, all the rest of the books, with the exception of the writings, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs, Job, those were considered the writings. Daniel in Hebrew scriptures, prophets in Christian scriptures, again, there's a little bit of complexity there, but for the most part, Jesus is saying, do you want to follow the law and the prophets? Do to others as you would have them do to you. Now, the first part of this, however, often gets an immediate objection. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be open to you. People say, it doesn't work. I ask for things. In fact, I've even asked for good things. I've asked for things that are obviously good. If a child is ill and dying, to avoid an accident, things that seem so obviously clearly to be in line with God's will, they don't happen. So why would Jesus lead us on by giving us such a blanket invitation? In fact, ask and it will be given. We're told to ask. Knock and the door will be open to you, for everyone who asks receives. And we say, how can you mean this, Jesus? It doesn't seem to happen. It's very interesting, though, because this passage receives immediate skepticism, but what I find with people who may be well outside the Christian realm, it doesn't stop the practice of wishful thinking. And every generation it comes up. Sometimes it's called Est, or the answer, or the law of attraction, or the power of positive thinking. Again and again and again, you will find someone on the internet who is basically saying, well, here it is. You've got to do these things and you will attract good things your way. Now, it's very interesting that on one hand, people say, no, it doesn't work. God doesn't listen. On the other hand, there's people who have very vague notions of God or the universe or however they distill the world down, and they say, oh, yeah, it definitely does work. Because in many ways, if you live your life, you realize, does it never work? No, actually, we very much get what we ask for sometimes. And what's interesting is that people, when they make this objection, they often don't note that, well, sometimes they do get it. And so where you're sort of based in is sometimes you ask and it's given to you. One of the interesting examples of this is in the book of Exodus, where we'll go after the Sermon on the Mount, because the children of Israel forget God's name completely. They don't even know what to call him or how to address him, but they're crying out. And in a sense, God answers poorly addressed mail and responds to them and rescues them. And this is a common picture in the Bible of the way God acts. So people seldom ask this question, does it never work? No, it sometimes works. And they'll say, well, correlation is not causality, and that's exactly right. But when we're leaning into this, what do we really want? Well, what we really want is to be able to say a prayer and get what we want guaranteed. That's what we want. And that is not a small power, because ask for anything and get it? Well, you might think that you would like that power, but you probably don't want anyone else to have it like you would, because you'd be very concerned about the character of the other person. What if this person asks for something that is not in alignment with my interests? What if this person asks for the Yankees to win instead of the A's? What if this person asks that China, who may have more Christians in it than the United States, what if they ask that China become a global dominating power? What if they ask that they win the lottery and not me? In other words, when you start and you think about this, you very quickly realize that this is a power that I want to have for me, and this begins to reveal something about our hearts. Now, after C.S. Lewis died, his assistant compiled a book of a number of essays that he had written over the years, and the book was entitled God in the Dock. And in that book, there's a tiny little chapter, it's just a few pages really, called Work and Prayer. And C.S. Lewis makes a number of observations along these lines. He begins with what was a common complaint, a common objection to this passage that was in the 19th century and early 20th century, which it's very interesting that you almost never hear this objection anymore. The objection goes like this. Even if I grant your point and admit that answers to prayer are theoretically possible, I shall still think they are infinitely improbable. I don't think it at all likely that God requires the ill-informed and contradictory advice of us humans as to how to run the world. If he is all wise, as you say he is, doesn't he know already what is best? And if he is all good, won't he do it whether we pray or not? This is a very common objection, which basically says, if God is running the show, why should he listen to us? In fact, it would be a very bad idea to listen to us. Now, the reason that this idea comes out of the 19th and early 20th century is because there's quite a bit more skepticism among many people as to whether there is a God or whether that God runs any show or not. And in fact, one of the scariest thoughts that many of these people would have would be, if there is a God, can I trust that God? Lewis continues, in every action, just as in every prayer, you are trying to bring about a certain result. He's talking work and prayer. And this result may be good or bad. Why then do we not argue, as the opponents of prayer argue, and say that if the intended result is good, God will bring it to pass without your interference, and if it is bad, he will prevent it happening whatever you do? Why wash hands? If God intends them to be clean, they'll come clean without your washing them. If he doesn't, they'll remain dirty, as Lady Macbeth found, however much soap you use. Why ask for the salt? Why put on your boots? Why do anything? In other words, C.S. Lewis points out that, well, we're talking about causality, and the assertion is that there's a power of causality in prayer, and this is a thing that we're skeptical of. And again, people earlier were skeptical of it because they said, God has everything in control. We shouldn't bother asking. He's going to do his will. He shouldn't listen to us anyway. Today we say, well, there is no God, or I don't believe there is a God, or, you know, it doesn't seem to work. But here's the point. We have all kinds of causality. We have hands, we have eyes, we have cars, we have jobs, we have all these kinds of things. We pick up things, we move things around. We've got all sorts of causality. And if the universe were as complained about, why would we wash our hands? Why wouldn't God just make our hands so that they would stay clean all the time? Why wouldn't our food be always perfectly salted? Why wouldn't the boots be on or off according to what would be best for us? But it seems that, in fact, we put things on. We have causality too. Pascal said, God instituted prayer in order to allow his creatures the dignity of causality. It would perhaps be truer to say that he invented both prayer and physical action for that purpose. He gave us small creatures the dignity of being able to contribute to the course of events in two different ways. He made the matter of the universe such that we can, in those limits, do things to it. That is why we wash our hands and feed or murder our fellow creatures. Similarly, he made his own plan or plot of history such as it admits a certain amount of free play and can be modified in response to our prayers. If it is foolish and imprudent to ask for victory in war on the ground that God might be expected to know best, it would be equally foolish or imprudent to put on a Macintosh, which is a coat. Does God not know best whether you ought to be wet or dry? In other words, Lewis is saying, why are you picking at this causality business? Lincoln, in his second inaugural, said, well, you know, some in the South are praying for their victory. Some in the North are praying for their victory. The Lord has his own designs, but yet people pray. The two methods by which we are allowed to produce events may be called work and prayer. Both are alike in this respect, that in both we try to produce a state of affairs which God has not, or at least at any rate not yet, seen fit to provide, quote-unquote, on his own. And from this point of view, the old maxim, labora et ora, work is prayer, takes on a new meaning. What we do when we weed a field is not quite different from what we do when we pray for a good harvest. But there's an important difference all the same. You cannot be sure of a good harvest, whether or not whatever you do in your field. Talk to any farmer, they'll tell you that. Farmers are always, will the weather be right? There's all sorts of variables that the farmers worry about, and they try to limit their variables. They work, and some of them pray. But you can be sure that if you pull one weed, that one weed will no longer be there. You can be sure that if you drink more than a certain amount of alcohol, you will ruin your health, and that it will go in, and that you will go on for a few centuries more, wasting the resources of the planets on war and luxuries. You will shorten the life of the whole human race. The kind of causality we exercise by work is, so to speak, divinely guaranteed and therefore ruthless. In other words, this causality that we do, that we commonly do, that we all recognize we do, that we hold each other accountable, this is divinely guaranteed. God gave us this power. By it, we are free to do ourselves as much harm as we please. By the kind which we exercise by prayer, is not like that. God has left himself a discretionary power. Had he not done so, prayer would be an activity too dangerous for man, and we should have the horrible state of things envisioned by Juvenal, that was an ancient writer, enormous prayers which heaven in anger grants. In other words, if God gave us that much power, well, he wouldn't be a very good God. Prayers are not always, in the crude factual sense of the word, granted. This is not because prayer is a weaker kind of causality, but because it is a stronger kind. When it works at all, it works unlimited by time and space. And if you decide to give yourself to prayer, often you will discover that prayers are sometimes answered in the long run. That is why God has retained a discretionary power for granting or refusing it, except that the condition of prayer would destroy us, or destroy our neighbor through us. It is not unreasonable for a headmaster to say, such and such things you may do according to the fixed rules of this school, but such and such things are too dangerous to be left to general rules. If you want to do them, you must come and make a request and talk over the whole matter with me in my study, and then we'll see. Now, you might argue that, well, the smart Dr. Lewis doesn't really solve the dilemma that we're asking for. Jesus says in his sermon, which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for fish, will give him a snake? Because aren't these fairly simple things? And wouldn't it be obvious by the teaching of this passage itself that, well, which of you would give a son bread if he asked for bread, would give him a stone? Why doesn't God give us good things all the time? Children grow hungry, and far worse. We're still able to blame God for not preventing all the pain we see. And in fact, what he says next insults a good many people, because they tell me they're insulted by it. If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? And people say, he's calling me evil? In the world that I see, where children go hungry and wars ravage and the strong take the weak, he's calling me evil? Surely if I were manager of the world, then there would be no war. Except, how would you stop the Holocaust? Or there'd be no hunger. But would there also be obesity? And everyone would get what they wanted. Well, would that really make everybody happy? And what if what they wanted was in conflict with one another, which, if you're paying any attention during your life, you realize two men want the same woman. Two people want the same job. Two people want the same home. People who share a home want very different things, and in fact, do evil to each other in order to try to get it. So, are you really sure, as a manager, you would be better than God? Because, generally speaking, if someone has a great deal of uninterrupted power over the details of another person's life, we call them a tyrant, and their agency is almost always unwelcome. And this brings us back to the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule is not original to Jesus. You can find it in Confucius. You can find it among the Jews. You can find it a good many places by a good many people. Many people have noted, well, it's pretty much the law of reciprocity. And it's not necessarily love. Sometimes I don't do things to others because I'm afraid they're going to do back to me what I do to them. So I might hold the door open to them. I might not rob them. I might not hit their car. I might not slap them in the face for fear that they'll hit me back. It's, in fact, not a terribly original rule. It seems rather obvious. Now, but here's the thing. You want to show up God. God is such a tyrant because he allows all of these bad things to happen, and you want to show him up. You have agency and causality in small ways. What do you do with your agency and causality? Even this most obvious, simple rule, do you keep it? Would your neighbors say you keep it? In fact, what we talked about last week deals with that directly, because the way we look at things, we think see things clearly, and we think our neighbors don't see things anyway as they should. And Jesus says, hey, take the log out of your own eye before you start monkeying around with the sawdust in somebody else's eye. Don't judge. We talked about that last week. Is your judgmental attitude towards God actually unique and exclusive towards God? Or, in fact, do you want this unlimited power of prayer to be used against your political adversaries, or your racial adversaries, or the adversaries on your street, or in your business, or in your school? Because you've got an idea of the way you think the world should work. And if you had unlimited power, do you really think the rest of us would praise you for it? Your attitude towards God is likely a reflection of your attitude towards your neighbors. And that's the whole point of this most obvious golden rule that, well, it's getting complicated very quickly. Do you use the agency you have with those who disagree with you? Maybe we'd pray that no one would cast a vote against the political party that you think should be out of office. Is this really the world that you want? So my friend Warren says, try it. Go ahead. Practice the golden rule. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Go ahead and judge God if you want, or decide not to believe or to act as if he's not there. God seems quite capable of taking our indifference and the disrespectful and the words we like to say against him. You take the golden rule and practice it in all of your affairs. And what's interesting is that this reminded me of Jordan B. Peterson's, one of his rules for 12 Rules for Life, set your house in perfect order before you go criticize the world. Because here's the thing, that rule about sawdust and planks, that holds pretty true. People don't like to be judged. People are judging all the time. And human beings differ greatly on the way they think the world should be run. But yet Warren's challenge remains. Why don't you try it? Because actually, if you try it, you might learn some things. You might learn that giving people what they say they want and loving them are sometimes two very different things. You might learn that many of the sufferings we are subject to are partially self-inflicted and the products of the use of our own small amounts of agency. You might learn that many of our problems are the direct results of past attempts, in fact, to make our dreams come true. The car that you feel saddled with now was once the car of your desires. The spouse that you feel saddled with now, you once stood on a stage and promised undying love to just that one person. And if you can't do it for just one person, you're going to manage it to the other 7.8 billion people on the planet, and you think what they know, you think what they should know, you think what is best for them? Or do you think all of those people even know what is best for them, or even know what they want? Recently, there have been shows about the afterlife. And in these afterlife shows, whether it's a computer simulation that you upload yourself to in the show Upload, or whether it's a little bit more ontological and real in The Good Place, what all of these shows come to discover is that we can't even, with unlimited power, design a perfect world for ourselves. And in almost every case, the participants wish themselves out of existence, or they simply can't agree on what is good. There's a lot of skepticism about whether, with unlimited power, we could create for ourselves a world in which we would achieve what our hearts long for, even if we know what that is. And actually, Augustine saw this centuries ago when he wrote, "Our hearts are restless until we find our rest in Thee, O Lord." In fact, we don't even know what we want. We don't know what we need. And if we simply got everything we asked for, we would make a mess of others' lives as well as our own. Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took his disciples up to the Garden of Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." Not a big ask. Peter himself had promised undying devotion to Jesus and that he would lay down his life for him, something which would be tested in a few hours, and Peter would fail. And he took with him Peter, James, and John, and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." He asked them to be with him. "Just be with me. Just stay awake with me. Just sit with me, because I know what's coming." And going a little further, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." "Ask and it shall be given. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be open." Jesus is asking. He's asking in earnest. Is anybody more moral than Jesus? Is anybody more sinless than Jesus? Is anybody more knowledgeable than Jesus? Is anybody more perfect than Jesus? All of these excuses about not getting what you want because you're sinful. Well, Jesus had no sin. Not getting what you want because it's out of line with the will of God. Jesus prayed prayers that healed the sick and raised the dead and stilled the storm. Surely, this would be the direct application of what Jesus is teaching, right? "If things are possible, remove this cup from me." And then he came and found them sleeping. And he said, "Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? No. Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation, that you might not come to the time of testing." Peter came to the time of testing, and he failed that test. "The spirit is willing," Peter says, "I'll do anything." But you can't even remain awake an hour. "But the flesh is weak." And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know how to answer him. And he came a third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. See, my betrayer is at hand." Jesus asked, and it was not given. He knocked, and God didn't answer. Even the Father said no to even the Son. A scorpion, a snake. Why? It was for me. It was for you. This is love. This is why you can trust him. If you practice it, you will learn you're no good at it. Which is exactly why to practice. You know, there's this thing in movies called a Mary Sue. A Mary Sue is someone that first try gets everything right magically. They don't have to go into years of training. They don't have to go into years of trying. Well, in some ways, the golden rule is your gym. Do to others what you would have them do to you. Okay. But then you begin to learn, what would I want? I would want them to love me. I would want them to actually do for me, if I knew everything, what would be best for me. Do you know whether or not God is doing this for you? Can you trust him? Because, well, here's the thing. We should do this out of gratitude. Because you can't save the world. In fact, if you were given unlimited powers, I'm not confident you would do any better than what we would see. In fact, my guess is you'd do worse because, and the same is, of course, true for me. If I were running history, yeah. You can only respond to it having been saved. That's the way this works. And on the way, by practicing the golden rule, you will participate. You will have agency in this transformation of you, this transformation of your neighbor. You'll get lots of things wrong. That's for sure. You'll learn how bad at it you are. That's for sure. But bit by bit, we'll begin to understand what love requires, and that love is the answer, and that this is the only way forward.